7th, 1971.
Okay, so we're talking about the press release of the Melnad discovery. For something of the order of a week, only the group knew. The four discoverers, myself, I think Dave Heesian, possibly one or two other people locally, kept it fairly
few wives.
A few wives, yes. But it's very difficult to do that at a national observatory because, for example, the output of the computer is fairly common. People can wander by and look at other people's output. Not on purpose, mind you, but with some strain, right?
No one would ever do that on purpose.
And then one or two visitors at NRAO found out about this. And despite a certain amount of swearing to secrecy, the word slowly got out. The details, I guess, are fairly immaterial. But I learned that it first emerged at a Cornell colloquium, carried on by someone from Harvard. So almost immediately, Cornell and the Harvard people knew about this. The next thing that happened was that it appeared in the Boston Globe in the morning edition through an article that was written by Victor McElhaney. I was away that day and was returning to the observatory in the evening, and when I got home at about 6 o'clock, I received a frantic phone call from one of the participants, Buell or Snyder, saying that they had gotten a call from Walter Sullivan from the New York Times. Could they tell him about the details of formaldehyde? What should they do? Well, the justification for the call from Sullivan was that it had already appeared in the Boston Globe, and if it was there, then was it not at that point common knowledge? Well, the only thing to do at that point is to just talk about it. So discussions were held by telephone to Sullivan, and at the same time we began to get worried about our interface with Fizrev Letters, because the editor there knew that we were trying to keep the secret. And so we called the editor at 10 o'clock at night at home. This was not Sam Gauchnik. It was another editor in his office. Gauchnik at this point was on the West Coast. We had a discussion with him, told him the cat was out of the bag. He more or less threw up his hands and said, well, we tried. But the very next day, when Gauchnik was winging his way back from the West Coast, apparently he sat down in Chicago and bought a newspaper and saw it. And we got a very irate telephone call saying that NRAO had in some way caused this to get into the paper, and he was upset about it, that it was contrary to the position that the journal was taking, and in essence that we were very bad boys.
So Fisher of Letters considered this a pretty important article themselves.
I presume so, yes. Although, in fairness, I don't think that it got any preferential treatment in Fizrev Letters. On the other hand, it wasn't delayed either. So, at any rate, this phone call went through, and we were properly chastised for having done something beyond our control. And we were rather upset about this, I think. But we learned later from Bob Holcomb, who was in on the other end of the conversation, that at the end of the conversation, Sam Gauchnik put the telephone down and grinned and said, well, that'll hold him for a while. Let's go for coffee. So that's the end of the formaldehyde tale. It was a rather intriguing one.
But they did publish it.
Oh, yes, they did publish it. It came out.
How much time was that before it came out after this?
My recollection is that the time was only of the order of a few weeks. 2 to 3 weeks, something that's over to you.
Are you more or less in charge of PR for NRAO?
Yes.
That's true.
We try to spot things that are newsworthy, things that the press might be interested in. And we do this not only for our staff, but also for visitors.
Take them over before the president. Have you found that the press is... Are they always trying to get around you, or...?
No. I think that the press... if you try to hold something for the press, and the press learns about it, the press will not go to us, because this puts them into a situation where we would ask them not to do it, and then they would be morally bound not to do it. And in the case of McElhaney, who's just being a good reporter, mm-hmm. he found this out from a route that I'm not quite sure of, but I have a suspicion of one or two people that probably leaked it to him. And instead of calling back and asking me or asking the principals, right, sure. he just began asking other people about the significance and about whether or not it had been found. And he was reasonably certain that it had been found. It was a good news story.
Right.
And so he released it.
And he always likes to scoop all the results.
That's right. But on the other hand, I'm sure that if I had gone to him to begin with and said, here's the story, we'd not like to have it out until so less than such a date, then they would have honored
yeah,
that.
Right.
And that's what we were doing in cooking up this press release with the American Institute of Physics office, but that time scale was just a little bit too long.
So what about the, as we just mentioned, it was shortly thereafter that CO and CM and HCM and the whole array. Has this all gone much more smoothly? Was this the formaldehyde sort of?
Yeah, formaldehyde, I think, was the crest of all of this. The other ones, there was a tendency after lines were discovered since then to try also for quick publication. But that route of quick publication generally meant that they were trying to get in something like the IAU circular. And then having done that, follow it up by something like the Astrophysical Journal Letters. I think that as a result of our interface with Physical Review Letters, which rapidly got around the community, that others did not particularly want to publish there first.
Yeah.
And they took the astronomical literature route. Do it. And the time scale for that is of the order, I think, of a few weeks if the article is sort of
yeah.
No? A month?
6 weeks.
A month and a half to 2 months.
Right now.
Yeah.
Six weeks.
Yeah. Other lines have been handled in many different ways. Some of them have been handled by the discoverers themselves with NRAO interfacing or not. Our policy is completely up in the air. If our local people do it, we certainly want to get involved.
Yeah.
We put out releases sometimes through the National Science Foundation, sometimes through NUI. Sometimes we'll do it ourselves, just give it to, for example, somebody local. A lot depends on the time scale.
Well, to switch slightly, can you think of, that's certainly been one of the more important discoveries in NRAO since you've been here.
Why don't you talk about that?
I can tell you some interesting stories about the first days of LH, too.
This is Garrett Bashir.
It's a long story.
Well, I'm going to get you, right, because actually most of my interviews so far have been on OH, just so
I can tell you
for
about
a chance.
The LH.
I've gotten the Harvard story and the MIT story. When I get Nandita, I'll get some Berkeley.
If you want the story, I came to the States in 1965, and I went to all three of those places, and I got three.
Completely different story.
I can tell you what I really
Yeah, I would like to talk with you, but just for some organization on these tapes, I'll stick with Bill right now. We can think about other things now, but in a more general sense about the importance of NRAO in U.S. astronomy, obviously it's been the leading guiding light, shall we say. To what do you attribute this? Is it all the director? Is it the way the NSF has got it set up? Or is it that much better than other national organizations?
I think it's a combination of two things. It's a combination, first of all, it's a unique combination of two things. The director plus the realization on the part of the funding agency that you've got to have approximately this level of support to have a good, viable visitor institution. So once the money is available for what we want to do, and in particular I'm thinking about operations money and money to keep the telescopes and the receivers up to date, capital money is another question that we've been fighting for quite some time. But initially the capital money was there, and the rate at which we built it and the way in which it was managed, I think both of these were uniquely combined in order to make NRAO the way it is. I think locally, the main ingredient has been Dave Heeshan. Here you've got a guy who is young, who's viable, who's grown up with the science from the beginning, who has evolved with it, and understands what's needed in order to do a good piece of science. recognizes it when he sees it. And what he tries to do locally is to create the conditions under which scientists can work relatively uninhibited and to spend all the time he wants at science and to do what he wants in a rather laissez-faire way. Science is not managed here. It's let loose.
Mm.
And I think it's that particular ingredient, plus the fact that you try to strive for people on the scientific staff who are novel and original, and not tie the observatory down to doing work that is primarily a piecemeal type thing for other people. The whole philosophy is to have very large, unique instruments which people will want to come and use.
Yeah.
To try to make them as flexible as possible so that the myriads of programs that people want to run in a given year can run and not get tied down to a rigid system.
This is what we're discussing last night.
Yeah, yeah. And in a sense, to keep loose scientifically and to let the guys with the ideas have their reign.
Yeah, well, the average staff age is pretty young, is it not, for this staff?
It is, but I think if you take any comparable institution, I'm not sure that you'll find one, but let's say take Kent Peake. No, not Brookhaven. It's more mature than we are. But take Kent Peake. It started about the same time. I suspect you'll find there the average age of the staff is
That's
about
true.
The
you
same
have to compare the age of the institution, right?
On the other hand, I think that the personalities that the two institutions have developed is somewhat different. And I think that the success of NRAO is not just due to a low mean age of the staff. I think it's due to lots of other things, too. I think that you'll find that other institutions have low mean ages, too. The new ones, Bond probably does, Westerbork probably does. These two institutions are a little too young yet to know exactly what they'll do at this point. But I think the success of NRAO is not just due to a low mean age.
No,
it's due
I just
to good management,
yeah.
I think.
What is the ratio between permanent staff and postdocs and that sort of thing?
Well, out of a staff now of, say, 26 people, we have 13 postdocs, let's say, and the rest on permanent staff.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
And I wanted to clarify now, you say NSF, despite all its recent troubles and cutting back right and left everywhere else, has not cut into your operations budget, at least significantly.
Our operations budget in ensuing years has never been less than the previous year. So from that standpoint, they have not cut our budget. Purchasing power of what we're getting is very nearly equal to what it has been before, but we have not expanded the staff over about 230 permanent staff members in 2 or 3 years now. So from that standpoint, we're mature in numbers. This does not mean that people go in and out. It just means that the total number has not increased.
So there's a 9-to-1 ratio between scientists and supporting people. Engineers, grounds maintenance, secretaries, computer programs.
That's right.
I didn't remember this intention.
Well,
of course, you got all the visitor support too. It's not
yes,
just staff.
It might seem high. You have to realize that supports 40%. Supports 100% of the observing, but only 40% of that observing is done by the staff.
Right.
So that when you're talking about numbers of people, raw numbers of people, you're talking about 150 visitors each year at two sites. You're also comparing NRAO, which is wholly self-contained by its entire staff, with other ratios in universities where many of the things that are done here are done by people that are not in evidence.
Right.
For example, there are fiscal departments in universities
right.
that you won't count when you're talking about a support.
When you look at the surrounding department.
So I don't think that ratio is abnormally out of bounds.
Has anyone ever worked on the numbers of what percentage of U.S. radio astronomy is done in NRAO?
Yes. Garrett Vishkir has worked up some numbers like this. And I have worked up some numbers just based on the last IAU Mission 40 bibliography list. And it turns out that U.S. radio astronomy is overwhelmingly prevalent in the areas of spectral line
oh, yeah.
Molecules, recombination lines, hydrogen and OH, and so on. It also turns out that I think if you look at the leading journals over the past 3 or 4 years, something over 60% of all the papers that have been published are based on work that has been done at NYU.
All journals in the world?
All journals, well, no, these were journals like the Astrophysical Journal.
American journals?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry, you look only at American papers in all leading journals.
I see.
Including let's
in Radio
AA.
Astronomy?
No. Well, yes.
In
yes,
Radio Astronomy,
yes,
and 60%
yes.
of those had something to do with NREO.
Yes. Well, it had to do with work done at NREO, not only by our own staff, but by visitors.
Right.
And that ratio has kept at about 60% for 2 years, and slightly less the year before that, and slightly less the year before that. So it grew and it grew to about 60 to 65%. And I think for a couple of years now, it's been about level at that. This is partly due to the fact that our mix has not changed very much. The numbers of people that we're able to push through the telescopes hasn't changed that much, just because we haven't gotten more telescopes.
You're right, you sort of saturation effect
that's
taking place. And has this increased the pressure for time? I mean, are the number of proposals going up relative to what you can give out?
The number that we receive per unit time now is approximately the same as it has been a year or so past. But there was a marked increase to bring it to that point from prior years. We get proposals at the rate of, say, one every 3 days, something like that. It may be even a little bit more right now.
This gets me into a whole other area of your expertise, which so for some reason occurred to me, namely the whole business of proposals and how they're decided and so forth. Well, the first obvious question is what percentage of proposals actually get at least part of the timely answer?
I would say over 90%, 90 to 95%. It depends on the telescope, too. On the 300-foot, almost virtually all. On the 36-foot, the 140-foot, something of the order of 90-95%. I can't speak as much for the interferometer, but I'm pretty sure that in that case, the statistics are quite similar.
And what percentage of time is typical to give a person relative to what he asks for? Of course, this varies.
Well, if you take the whole mix and integrate over everyone of time that they get divided by time that they have requested, the answer is about 2/3. On the other hand, some groups get 100%. Some people get far less.
Some get 200%.
Some may get 200%.
Rarely.
Well, for example, a person might want an 8-hour stretch of observing, and he might come from hundreds of miles away. In order to ensure that he's got that 8 hours because of the vagaries of weather and equipment breakdown and so on, we might schedule him for twice that. On the other hand, on a 5-day program, we won't schedule him for 10 days. And we would rarely schedule anyone on 140-foot now for much over a week. If he sincerely needed more time, I'm not sure that he would get it at once. He might be asked to do it now and then come back and do the other part of it. There has been a lot of criticism over this, and the main criticism is that this delays their publication in the one case, or in the other case, they are publishing with data that don't quite give them the signal-to-noise ratio that they'd like to have.
The fact that you're limiting things to a week or so.
Of that, yeah.
In general, how do you find the relations between NREO and the visitors relative to this business in which proposals are accepted? Do people think the system works pretty well? Or
I think they do. If you compare I'm not the proper person to ask because I'm on the fire
running it, right?
Yes. But I think compare the criticisms that our constituents have with us, with the criticisms that maybe other national observatories have, I think that you'll find that we come out relatively well. That's just saying that there's some average amount of criticism that any national observatory would expect. There are many ways that this criticism can take place. It can take place to me verbally, to other members of the NREO verbally. It can sometimes get written to me or to the director. It can come up at users' committees. It can come up at the visiting committee meetings. It can come up directly to the National Science Foundation through their committee system. There are lots of checks and balances to see whether or not we're doing a good job.
Does the users' committee really have much pull or weight?
It's advisory to the director, and what it does is to get together the group of people who use us most actively, of the order of twice a year, so that we can tell them what it is we plan to do and to seek their advice in the somewhat farther term as to what we should be doing. gives them a chance to criticize the operation if they want, or to help us point the direction in a more gentlemanly manner if they want. This doesn't get done quite as much during the sessions as it does in the halls, yeah. Two by two. I think either way, it's effective.
Now, it's been my impression, though, that it's more the heads of various departments and small observatories around the country. It's not really the people that use it the most, like you said. For instance, Connie Mayer at NRL, he's not the one that's using NRL the most at NRL.
Well, you've got to look at this historically. It turned out that in the beginning, there were maybe 10 or 15 people on the users committee. And we felt in the beginning that there ought to be an institutional representative. And the obvious guy was the head guy at that institution. Right. So you invite him to come and hope that if he has a group, he will carry the word back to that group.
And hope that they will likewise give him the prize.
Now you take Connie, for example. Connie has not used as much in the recent past, but back at the time when he first got on the committee, he was using this very often.
Yeah.
And not only that, Connie sometimes does not come now, but he will send a younger person
right.
in his place.
That's true too.
And so there has been two tendencies. One tendency is that these old-timers tend to use us less. In some cases, they will substitute for themselves some younger person on the staff. Sometimes they won't.
But, so in a way, it's more the institutions that are represented in the...
Well, that is the original philosophy, but if you look to see what's happened, the numbers of people have gone from this initial early number of 10 to 15 up to something in the order of 30. Now, not all those 30 come at every meeting. They have the opportunity to come. But one finds that there are younger people and institutional multi-representation. Mm-hmm. For example, at the University of Maryland, where you're from, there must be two or three people in the board that have come.
Yeah.
And so we broadened it. There's no longer the exact institutional representation. In broadening it, I think we brought in younger people too. So the idea of a pure institutional representation has gone by the board a little bit, but not all that much.
One thing we haven't talked about as far as the excellence of NRAO is the electronics area. You said certainly a high level of funding is necessary in order to keep an engineering and R&D sort of program going.
Yeah.
But once again, this can't happen without the good engineers and,
right.
and the good interaction with the astronomers.
That's right.
Now, who do you think?
Well, there's been an evolution in this. I think that a number of people are responsible for the electronics development who have dealt closely with it. The first being John Finley, the second being Hank Bottom, and the third being Sandy Wyman. Back in the very early days, astronomy, radio astronomy, had the idea that the way to develop the instruments was to have a package that we wanted to see, a set of specifications for a particular receiver that could be built by an outside firm. That would be delivered to us almost in the stage where it could be put on the telescope and used right away. It turned out that I think with the arrival, it was either early Hain Bottom or late John Finley, we came to the conclusion that this perhaps was not the way to do it, and we ought to experiment by having electronics engineers on our staff for a fairly high caliber who could spot the proper components that we could buy, the best components, and then put them together in a way that was uniquely radio astronomy. Something that we would have expected the companies to do under the prior philosophy, but something that they really didn't do because they weren't going to use it. And they weren't going to be responsible for it after they sold it to us.
Well, in short, an in-house capability.
An in-house capability, right.
Bottom and Finley were predecessors as head of the electronics.
That's right, that's right. And this was one contribution, I think, that was made, and as it was realized, it sent the observatory a long way toward preeminence in the area of radio astronomy electronics. That, plus the standardization of back ends, which Hain was marketing responsible for, plus the standardization of front-end boxes, where one front-end box could be interchangeable between one telescope and another. Not only here at NRAO, but if you look further into the future, one of these front-end boxes could very easily be clamped on another telescope somewhere else if we wanted to loan the equipment out.
Right.
This has been successful up to this date only to a degree. There are are some telescopes that have compatible foci and others that don't. But in every case of the new ones that were built, we strongly urge that they become compatible. And in some instances, they've gone that route, and in some instances, they haven't.
This is both in the focal ratio as well as the size of the front-end structure.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
So the two main things you have to
do. That's right. That's right. Then, with the maturity that came in this in the electronics division, one has seen and is now seeing a similar maturity, I think, occurring also in the computer division. Because there were times when we used to have analog output, punch card output, and finally stepping tape recorder output, and finally magnetic tape output, and now we're getting into wideband MPEX output for ALB.
Right.
And each time you make a jump like this, you're asking for a more and more sophisticated computer system. This takes more backup from the standpoint of either large-scale computers to do the final reduction, or online computers to do it at the telescopes, and takes at the same time fairly sophisticated people to handle the large computer instead from a programming and system standpoint. And I think that one can see that with about 1964 or 65, when we made the jump from the IBM 1620 to the 7040, we began to get far more sophisticated than we had in the past. And we're now tied in with an IBM 360, which I think does the job fairly well, although there are others that think CDC is better.
I would be one of them. But anyway, so was this Peter Stumpf who really got the computer thing rolling, would you say? Or?
There were a combination. There was a gained... The observatory was broken down in the very early stages. I guess it was a combination of converted computer operators who were doing the computing. And I was acting head for a while until about 66 or 67, and then Peter Stumpf took over. I think during the time I was there, we went to a closed shop on the computer. It used to be open shop prior to that. We went to closed shop, we went to the 7040 system, and we designed the 360 system. We had gotten the first programmers from outside the observatory, people like Joe Meinhall, who was still with us, and Paul Hitch, and a few other people who were not. And then Peter Stumpf came in, and he carried on, I think, pretty much the same philosophy. Again, I'm a little bit too near this myself to make that sort of comment. I think others might make it better. Picture on that going on. But Peter left to go back to Bonn, and now George Conant has been with us for something like over a year.
Well, I think that, unless you think of something now that something else you'd like to comment on. You have another good anecdote, like the formaldehyde?
Oh, full of them, but I'm not sure just which ones to pick.
Well, thank you very much. Okay, testing, it's on the table now. Okay, now we're on top of the recorder. Bill Howard also mentioned that on the Lou Snyder, Dave Buell proposal that they did mention galactic sources as secondary search sources. You want to tell the Schlossky story over? Otherwise, I'm going to do my version of it.
I think the Russians might read it.
Well, I'm going to tell it. Right, so you have the choice. You can listen, make sure I tell it straight.
Okay.
No, Bill told me that.
Okay, go ahead.
This story was occurred about 2 or 3 days after the after Stalin and Riefenstein had discovered the Crab Nebula pulsar, and. I was phoning Shklovsky in Moscow from Charlottesville to try to find out whether or not he would come to the Jansky lecture, which we had invited him to in November of that year. And the telephone connection took 5 days to make, and finally I got a hold of him. Well, his English was not very good, He had not been in the country very long, nor had he spoken English for very long. And so when I finally found out all I wanted to know, well, I didn't find out what I wanted to know.